Hello, this is futurist Gerd Leonhardt in Zurich, Switzerland. Today, in a podcast conversation with Peter Van, also from the Futures Agency. Hello, Peter.
Hello, Gerd. Good morning.
Hello. And this is number 11 in our podcast series about my book, Technology versus Humanity, Tech vs. Human, techversushuman.com. And today we're talking about chapter 11, which is called Earth 2030, Heaven or Hell. And this has become a very big topic in my speeches, what I call Hell-Ven, the combination of heaven and hell. You can see the hashtag on Twitter on the same topic. But I'm going to pass it over to Peter. Peter is the host and the person whose job it is to grill me, well, literally, or not, and to ask smart questions. So thanks for tuning in, and Peter, take it away.
When I first saw the title of the chapter, I thought it would be a lot about like dystopian doom type of scenarios, but it absolutely is not. And I like the way how it is presented here in a number of scenarios for every 2 years, like 2020, 2022, 2024, up to 2030. Mm-hmm. And I know that in your talks, Gerd, you often start with saying science fiction is already becoming science facts. And so a number of the things that you, in your book, projected for 2020, that's next year, most of them have already become science fact. Your book was in 2016, published in 2016, I believe. And I had a very similar experience last week when watching Elon Musk's presentation about his robotaxis strategy. Like this, it's a 2.5 hour story where the other quote that you or meme that you often use in your talks, it's gradually, then suddenly. Mm-hmm. So those two together, if we look at 2020, what you foresaw for 2020, it's hyperconnectivity and hypermanipulation.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know that Elon has gotten most of these things from me, of course. Right?
Just kidding. Yeah, of course.
But you know, it's funny when you talk about this chapter and the hypermanipulation. It was quite clear in 2016 that social media is a way to manipulate already. Just like it was clear in 1999 that music is moving to the cloud. What has happened is, I think there's a really interesting story, is that what used to be a very good thing, connecting people and communicating in different ways, became so perfect and so powerful that it has become possible to use it as a weapon. And I think this is something that we have to be careful with technology in general, when, you know, too much of a good thing becomes a very bad thing. But also, if technology works perfectly, then it can be abused by people who understand how it all works. Right? And we need to have safeguards against that. So the hyperconnectivity, for example, 5G, great example.
Yes.
I mean, people are hyping 5G everywhere now, and I understand that it's vastly powerful and all, you know, never mind the health issues and stuff that people are discussing. But the fact that you can be overconnected, that you can be using it too much and become so dependent on connectivity that you basically outsource everything, and you feel like you're living in the cloud. And all of that is not a good development for us, because we're not just ephemeral beings. You know, we're not just a database. Like I think Jeff Hinton said a couple of days ago in one of his talks, is that humans are just neural networks, and therefore a machine. And it goes back to the same copy we have discussed many times, right? If you believe that we are just machines, then hyperconnectivity is good, right? And then you just have to figure out a smart mechanism to stop manipulation or to make it perfect, one of the two. And I believe that we're not. So I think the manipulation that we're seeing right now in social media has to be stopped by humanizing it, by putting the human back in, which means putting money into humans.
Right. But going back to Elon Musk's show, because it's... Yeah. I mean, there's probably a lot of reality there, but obviously he's on his way to collect, try to find $2 billion as a future investment. So it has to be a positive story. Mm-hmm. But when I listen to the power of these neural networks, like all these cars that are out on the road now are basically sensors that in real time are taking feeds from 12 cameras and sensors and feeding them live in real time to neural networks that keep on learning as if they're humans. It's very, very scary. I mean, your visions about Helvin are getting very close, and he is predicting that this will happen next year. So next year, 1 million robo taxis, completely self-driving taxis with based on neural network learning, next year.
Well, I think really what it means is, and this is of course the same strategy that IBM is using for their wares, selling their systems, is to say that this is something that is the goal. But what we're seeing right now is that these devices are assisting us. You know, they're not AI; they're intelligent assistants. I mean, you don't sit in the Tesla in the back. And like in RoboCop or so, you don't sit in the back and just do whatever you want. You're sitting actually in the driver's seat. You're not superfluous as a human. And even if you go with Waymo, which is currently only in Palo Alto, and there's a reason for that, given that the nature of traffic in Palo Alto in the suburbs is, a 5-year-old can drive there. Right? It's not like regular traffic. And level 5 autonomous driving, like a human, I think that's at least 20 years away. And I think by saying that you're going to have systems that can automate most of it when it's really simple, that's like saying that my computer can fill in the form on the website because it has memorized my facts, or Gmail can predict my answer in the email, you know? Mm-hmm. And I can say, yes, okay, that's a good idea. I can answer yes, no, maybe. Okay, that's nice, but it's not thinking, it's not learning. I mean, it's learning in a pattern kind of way, in a computer way. So I think this is part of the confusion about this discussion about whether things are going to be good or bad. I think a machine that could actually think and learn and feel like we do, mm-hmm. that would be very bad.
Why?
It would be extremely useful.
Why is that bad?
Well, it would be bad because we would, A, get really confused about who we are and who they are. Mm-hmm. If the so-called AGI, or the superintelligence. And B, I think the loss of control would be substantial because clearly we would depend on them completely. And we would probably tend to pull back and let them do everything for us, which would be a complete sort of deauthorization, an erosion of our own capability. And so this is why my argument is, let's use technology for the assistant part, which is huge and worth hundreds of trillions of dollars. And that should be plenty. Why do we need them to be like us, and thinking like a human? We have very little idea actually how humans think in the complete process of this. And this is why neural networks are just one piece of this equation. So I think basically this is a promise. And really what Elon is talking about is intelligent systems that could do most of the routine work of driving. Mm-hmm. But, would I take a self-driving car up and down Highway 1 in California and, have some fun? And I wouldn't. It would be extremely dangerous. And also there would be no point because I'm not having fun not driving. Would I use it in Los Angeles to drive to work where it's mostly traffic jam? Yes, of course. But those are two completely different cases. And I think the idea of saying that this car, autonomous car, can drive exactly like a human somewhere in Rome or Beirut or Jakarta, that's far-fetched.
That's 20 years away. So let's go back to the book, 2022. Mm-hmm. My best friend is in the cloud. So you describe the sort of digital me. You have called it Hello Me. Mm-hmm. And the hello me knows more about me than any human ever would. That's a strong statement.
Yeah, that's kind of what Google calls the, hello, hey Google, right? Mm-hmm. It's in a way that's also already here. I mean, the thing is that when you have a digital engine connecting information, collecting and connecting information about you from thousands of sources, that machine will have a lot of insights on who you are. For example, one sentence spoken to WhatsApp or Siri or Cortana contains more personal information than a million words. Mm-hmm. And that is because quite a few labs and researchers can tell from one spoken sentence what kind of sexual persuasion you have. Or
really?
Yeah. It's all in the way that you speak. It's like the information contained in how you behave when you speak is completely different than when you have text. Yeah. And so these systems can become very knowledgeable. They know things about us that we may not be aware of ourselves, given on that they can compare, hundreds of millions of other speeches. Right? So, latest discussion about Alexa and Google Home is that they do record, obviously, all that stuff. Mm-hmm. Because it creates a huge pattern and profile about me, which can be used for many, many things, mm-hmm. good things and bad things. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. But you say if I read the book correctly, you say on the other hand, it's a good thing because we will be freer than ever to contemplate, create, question, and ponder. Do you think that will be the case, that we will be freer?
Well, I think that is the question of the end of routine kind of question. When useful stuff is in the cloud, so for example, if my travel profile, all my likes and all my history is in the cloud, then I can just say to the assistant, please book my flight to Sao Paulo. You know how I like to do things. Right? Mm-hmm. And this is mostly about facts, not completely, but 99%. My feeling is I don't want to arrive in Sao Paulo at 2:30 a.m. or so, and the machine doesn't know that yet, so it has to learn. But basically, yeah, I can outsource that, and in the same time, I can keep working on my book. Right? That's a good equation. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, connecting with people that contact me or with friends, I wouldn't want to automate that at all because I think they deserve more than that. Mm-hmm. And that's the sort of the human contact that we need to keep alive, even if it may be less efficient. Mm-hmm. And so this is part of the challenge here. It's we have to use the good things, but then we have to put it to good work. So a doctor that's using AI, maybe 70% of the routine work, which is to prescribe medication or so, right? That can be outsourced to the intelligent assistant. Because that's all the information of the last 350,000 cases on this disease is available. But then he would have 50% more time, the doctor or she, and she could then really talk to the patient. Or she could say, well, in that case, I'm going to go back to my office and browse on Facebook, or do whatever. I mean, it's kind of our decision what we do with what the unlocking of the potential. And my feeling is that most of us will make good things out of it, mm-hmm. Kind of like the basic income, we'll make good things out of it, and some of us will not. Yeah. And that's something we have to see.
Yeah. The basic income comes a bit later in your timeline. Mm-hmm. Before that, in 2024, we say goodbye to privacy and anonymity. Mm-hmm. Also there, I think a number of the things that you describe are gradually but suddenly happening. Mm-hmm. I mean, you say we cannot avoid being tracked, observed, recorded, and monitored ever. Mm-hmm. This is making me think a lot about, we discussed it in a previous call as well, this Toronto Sidewalks project, mm-hmm. where there's so many sensors that it's not anymore about if you are monitored, but your right to be informed how you are monitored. So I see a sticker on a store when I walk in that I'm monitored on GPS, on audio, on voice, and on face mm-hmm. recognition. Cool. So there is no opt-in or opt-out, or I cannot avoid being tracked. So hence, goodbye privacy and anonymity. And there are some people recently also writing again. We see it every 2 years, the end of privacy.
Yeah, I mean, we have this recent book, the Surveillance Capitalism, right?
Yes.
What's the name of the author again? Anyway, it's called Surveillance Capitalism, and I think it describes really well as to what's happening. We're doing this not so that we can be safer. This is just a side effect, or allegedly safer. We're doing this because we can monetize all that stuff in new ways. And we're doing it because government appreciates the possibility of control. And like anything, if government is good, it's not a problem, like here in Switzerland. But if government is bad, like other places, you know, that is a real problem. So this is the power.
Look how careful we have become in saying like in other places, because we could be monitored.
Yes, and we are being monitored. And I think this is the chilling effect of this is quite clear. We're going to behave differently because it's all tracked and monitored. And somebody can say, you know, you said this about me and that's why you cannot immigrate. Mm-hmm. Or you said this about XYZ and that's why we're not going to have you as a speaker. Mm-hmm. Or you have done XYZ and this is why you can't rent the apartment. Mm-hmm. I mean, and that to me, that is not a good thing. That's dehumanizing. And this is why I think privacy and the whole issue of surveillance needs to be kept and controlled and discussed, because it goes to the sort of greedy thinking that, you know, when you have all the information in the world, then you can monetize in so many different ways and I can't do anything about it. I'm just kind of the victim of this. Yeah? I think that's a very bad idea because it leads to all kinds of consequences, including abdication, compulsory action, drawing back, losing my free will, whatever that can be defined as, and generally dehumanizing effects. And I think that's something we really have to speak out against.
Mm-hmm. You also look at the banks in this part of your timeline, mm-hmm. because you say that data is not only just the new oil, it's also the new money. Mm-hmm. And hence... well, not really hence, but banks are going to lose a substantial part of their income streams. So how would that be, Gert?
Well, I think if data is a new oil and if data can be seen as a valuable asset, the banks have the data, but they're not allowed to use it really, and they don't know how to use it, and their IT systems are most, by and large, 20 years old. Mm-hmm. They're not starting from scratch, and you know, and of course they're so comfortable that they're making, you know, it's like the record labels 20, 15 years ago. Why would you change anything if you're making 90% of the profits? And you know, when you're making $42 billion doing very little, except for administering the rights and taking care of distribution, you know, that's quite comfortable. Yeah. And we see where that's gone with the music business. And now it's the banking business saying, you know what, all of the low-hanging fruits like personal transactions, credit card payments, and on that note, of course, we know that the end of credit cards is coming from this, because why do we need these people? I mean, yeah, we're collecting miles. That's the only good thing about them, right? Mm-hmm. But otherwise, transacting, that's electronic. I mean, that's basically a 0.2% charge at maximum. Mm-hmm. And so the banks will lose all of those segments, like small loans, intercompany transfers. That will all be done in electronic ways that are essentially going to be like Spotify. Like it's just you make a flat payment or none at all. And then it just works. And the banks haven't realized, or they are realizing now, that this kind of way of saying, well, it just, this is the way it was and people trust us and we are, you know, and that will go on forever, and it will not.
Yeah. There was a really good quote recently. I don't know anymore who said it, or a meme, because some of banks are playing with the idea of being the trusted store for your data. So mm-hmm. not only your money, but also for your data. So, but the meme was around the idea of why would I trust a bank or any other organization with my data, where the ultimate goal is to make money out of my data by sharing it. The only way
that wouldn't work here. I think that The banks are in the tight spot because they're spoiled by previous profits, like the record industry. Their technology did completely backwards, most of them. And they have IT issues that are 20 years old. And then they've become complacent because of regulation. And the list goes on and on. So for banks to embrace data would mean that they would need another way of getting more login and more information supplied, becoming a platform, you know, platformization, basically, as some banks have been trying, like Charles Schwab, for example, in the U.S. with their intelligent advisor, and, you know, becoming essentially a platform for all financial matters. And I think if you, for example, if you're into wealth management, it's going to take more than just administrating your portfolio. You know, this is going to be about not being smarter because the information is out there, but about being more connected and having more interaction and also adding human value, human foresight, prediction, not just predictive analytics, but also prediction, human prediction, you know, understanding. I mean, why does Warren Buffett rank so high? Not because he's got a good computer. It's got experience and, of course, a lot of that too. So to me, that's... I think the next sort of record labels are really the banks.
Yeah, I like it a lot. It's a very sharp analysis. So you're basically saying anybody like banks who is in a pure transaction business is going to be Spotify'd.
Yeah, well, of course, this is what IT does. You know, information technology is the great sort of commodifier, you know, and it deflates. It deflates the margins, and not for the tech companies, of course, but for everybody else. And then we have to reinvent. But I mean, as you can see in the music business, there is new money for streaming, you know, 110 million or 20 million subscribers now, I think, right? But you're not going to get it. That's the equation. You know, the record labels are facing a very, very big challenge in that they used to get 90% of that money because everybody's listened to Madonna and Lady Gaga, right? But now we have all the choices. We're going to listen to, you know, Amazon trance music. And it's, I think it's going from 90% revenues to the major record labels and the big indies to 20 or 30% in the overall share.
So less income for the record labels. Less income for the humans who consume because the routine tasks are being delegated to computers and algorithms. So who is going to be, I'm getting into this, what you call the basic income guarantee. So if
So it's not. It's actually
going
not,
to spend what money? Basically,
it's actually not that record labels will get less money. They get more money, but it will not be the top four who will get all the money. You know, because we have all the choices, so it'll be more spread around. And when we have a billion subscribers with, say, €5 each a month, the industry will be bigger than before. But it will go into different directions, and recording rights and publishing will merge. For example, right. As a result. And so there's money, but the old guys aren't getting it. And the same is going to be with banking, insurance, and everything else, and healthcare. There's new money to be had, but you're not going to get it unless you find a new way to deal with the great commodification of IT and what I call the game changers, right? The eight big things like data, AI, IoT, and so on to understand those kind of things. And so I think really what's happening here is that it could be heaven, it could be hell in your business. But if you understand what is going to be next, like the car industry is now understanding that it's not about selling cars, it's about selling mobility. You know, then you can ride both horses. And, you know, when selling cars declines, then you have mobility. And it's not per se that you will not be needed, but it's what you used to do that declines in importance. For example, advertising and you know, printed advertising is declining, and digital advertising is a completely different beast. It's not the same at all. So, you know, it's called hybrid thinking, or we have to develop this kind of idea of hybrid thinking.
Okay, so that's the side of the companies.
And, you know, for the consumers, it means, of course, great abundance. So a lot more stuff for a lot less money. And the consumer wins, clearly. that goes for Spotify or Netflix or many others, you know, that are much cheaper.
If they still have a job and income.
Yeah, and this is the other side of the equation. Of course, the creator wins only if there's a large, a very liquid and large and fair system. And that has to be built, obviously. But clearly, you know, if there are no more credit cards, the consumers win if the alternative is reliable and good and strong and much cheaper, which it will be, I think.
Well, are those the characteristics of the fairer system? That's interesting. I haven't come across that element in your work so far. So all that is good if the consumer is functioning in a fairer system. What would that mean, a fairer system?
Well, I think fairness has to do with the fact that you have choices and control, and that you're not being locked into one model. You know? So iTunes, in my view, wasn't fair. In that sense that, you know, yes, you can say, okay, now I can finally buy music legally, which is the right thing to do, but it's $2 a song, which is ridiculous. That's kind of like, it's kind of like saying, yeah, you can afford AIDS medication for $80 a month, and that's fair, but, you know, Brazilians can't pay for it. Well, some of them can, but, you know, people in countries like that, this is not fair to them. Right? So to me, what's happening is that business has to change to accommodate that users have more leverage. And for creators, we have to realize that there's now many ways to monetize, not just distribution. And that's also not new. It's just more pronounced. And then government has to realize that we will not have a fair and equal system unless we put principles in place and regulations and laws and also social contracts, of course, that make sure that the power of technology and science is not overbearing against the general population. Because, you know, there's no way that we can protect ourselves against overbearing Facebook. We can just say, okay, we won't use it. We can say that. That's it. Right? But can we make a difference as to what the rules of engagement are for Facebook? Not really.
No, not really.
So that's the role of government is to be the great balancer here. And this is why government needs to read this book. sending it around to everyone, because I think it's really important that we understand that, because science and technology will be virtually limitless in the very near future, our job of balancing what science and technology can do with what we want to be done, which is hopefully a collectively prosperous society, that can only be done by government. It will not be done with the tech firms. I mean, this is like saying you're going to pay tax voluntarily.
That's a good one.
I mean, nobody's going to do that. I mean, do you really think that Google or Facebook or Alibaba would say, we're going to forego $3 trillion in profit because, you know, it's not the right thing to do? Mm. Yeah. Not really. Not even Larry. Or maybe him, you know, but he'll be voted down.
He will not feel it, but that's another discussion. But it's not another discussion, because these are the people who are really, really rich. And you, in your book, in 2028, that's your timeline. Mm-hmm. It's those people who can afford the luxury of being disconnected, of not being tracked. It's going back to the fairness and most probably the equality inequality principle that should be behind fairness, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I'm not against rich people enjoying their benefits. Not everybody should have a claim for a super yacht, you know. Mm-hmm. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about basic human things like maintaining my privacy, not being surveilled, having options to go offline, remaining in actual relationships, having meaningful work, right? Being fairly compensated. Those are the kind of things that are very basic things, and that technology is threatening, because it threatens it not by intent, by consequence and by extreme implementation. And so therefore, I think really it's the government's job to say, well, you know, if 50% of all large companies in the world automate most of their jobs and routine functions, which is coming, anything that does not require human ingenuity will be automated. So telecom companies, retailers, what have you, right? or, and of course, manufacturing, do we need an automation tax? Whatever we need something to equalize the relationship between input and output. And I think this is something where governments have to say, well, you know, if you're going to automate 80% of your staff, you know, T-Mobile or MTN or whatever, which is coming, you know, then, you know, do you have to create new jobs by some sort of scheme, or do you have to pay into a fund that retrains people or that changes education? Absolutely. Because what happens if we don't do this? We're going to have an extreme polarization of very rich people that can do whatever they want with their privacy and their own. They can even live in a completely like they do now in a compound, right? So like a mental compound of safety, mm-hmm. and you know, and they can do all of that. But and this would include ourselves, of course, because relatively speaking, we are rich compared to others who can't even make podcasts, right? So I think this is part of what we have to think about. If we want that to happen, we're talking about having to apply a more common sense to it. And this is, of course, the answer to terrorism and crime as well.
It was probably a lapsus, what you just said, or maybe I heard one, to apply common sense, but the more and more I listen to you, it's about applying commons sense.
Yeah, both. But you know, I think common sense really says, okay, what happens when you live in a system that's digital feudalism, and that is based on whoever holds the means of production, to quote Marx, right? Even though, of course, that we don't want to lean too much in that direction, the means of production, which is now the means of technology and data, whoever holds the data is holding the power. And that needs to be equalized so that the outcome can be a distributed wealth of some sort. Mm-hmm. And this is what we want in Europe, of course. This is our agenda in Europe. You know, we want collective benefit. And this is part of my speeches lately. I'm always talking about people, planet, purpose, and prosperity. So there's four different things, and prosperity is always a good thing. And I'm not against people being very prosperous. I think that there's still room for that. But prosperity and profit at all costs is the end of the road for us. So I think, you know, wrapping up this chapter here, right? I think in 2030.
Yeah.
We're going to be in a situation where it could be truly heaven if we were to use technology like desalination, renewable energy, solar energy, better batteries, and vertical farming and intelligent assistance. If we can use that all to our benefit, it could be heaven. Well, we're going to need government, public officials, politicians, intellectuals to make that happen. Right? And it could be hell if it's going to be used to further concentrate the amount of richness on one side, because, you know, they own the means of communication, of IT. They own the means of computing. And that is not a problem that I think is really necessarily their fault. It's a problem of consequence of that becoming exponentially powerful.
Wow. Makes me silent.
So, yeah, I'm an optimist. So just to wrap this up, you know, I think we can do this. We will have all the means we need. The question is, do we have the will? And the will is something we're working on. Of course, that discussion is going on everywhere. I think very few people would enjoy a world that is completely heaven for them, but hell for 98% of the rest. Now, I can't see that being a great solution. And there's somebody quoted the other day, saying that you can't do business on the in a world that's gone to hell. There's no point in having business if nothing else works. So I think that's sort of the wrap-up of the chapter here. So thanks, Peter.
Super. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Geert.
And just for information for the millions of you listening out there and in the cosmos, of course, as well, you can find out more about the book at Tech versus Human, Tech vshuman.com. It's now available in 11 languages. You can download one of the key chapters called The Megashifts at megashifts.digital. That's a free excerpt, also in 10 languages. I'm at futuristgerd.com, futuristgerd.com, and my YouTube channel is at gerdtube.com. And Peter is Peter Van, at Peter Van, right? Like yes. The van?
Yes.
on Twitter, and of course also on my blog, regularly posting and adding things to my blog. So thanks, Peter. And next week we're going to wrap up the book, right?
Is that the last chapter, chapter 12?
Yeah, I think it is. And I have to keep on reading it and reviewing it. But I think, yeah, we're wrapping up. Of course, there's a summary with a few other things, right? Chapter 12 is called Decision Time, and we'll talk about that next week's session. Thanks very much for tuning in, and see you down the road.
Have a great day.